Greetings, everyone. You're going to notice that this is a little different than the normal tape that we send you for Sabbath services. The reason being that the Sabbath services this past Sabbath here in Tyler were pretty much interrupted by a family reunion taking place next door through very thin walls, a lot of very yelling and noisy children, a lot of thumping and running around going on, and some technical difficulties. So we decided instead that following the television program, which I just now completed, I'm still seated here at the television desk. In a moment, I might even show you where I am, but I'm just going to be real informal about this because I'm seated here in my study, which is a combination trophy room and study, and right over there is the desk where I do all of my writing and have my personal computer and everything, and just talk to you about the work and perhaps get into some of the prophecies of the Bible as time goes on in the time that we can share here together. This is going to be seen, of course, by people all the way from Tasmania to Canada to Jamaica to Australia to France and England and Ireland, and I want to say greetings to all of you along the way who will be watching the video tape of these, usually the Sabbath services that we send, but of this videotape that we're going to be sending out. The clippings that I get from people who are helping me watch are very, very interesting sometimes, and a lady up in Alaska sent me one that is really fascinating. I'll show it to you. United States of Europe deserves look, it says. It's from a paper up in Anchorage, Alaska, and this is by a noted columnist, Richard Reeves. I want to read segments of it to you because I utilize this article in the current issue of World Watch, taking great issue with at least one thing he said. Paris, he was writing from Paris, the first big story of the 21st century is already happening and nobody noticed, at least nobody back home in the United States, he said. That is the United States of America. The story is about the United States of Europe, or an entity of 300 million people nicknamed Euroland, the 11 countries that have agreed to merge their currencies. At the end of this year, the countries will begin the process of eliminating marks, francs, lira, and eight other national currencies and creating a new currency, the euro. Before I go through much of this article let me just state right now that things are not really going very smoothly in some of the nations trying to get ready for the adoption of a common European currency. Now, we know that that is moving toward economic unity, but that doesn't necessarily mean that it's moving yet toward full political unity, and political unity is what the beast power is all about. The beast power, depicted in Revelation 17, 12 to 14, is a power that is going to coalesce from 10 nations which give all their power and strength, which means economic, industrial, and military, to the beast, and which are actually going to overwhelm all of Palestine and, we believe, the United States of America, and which will perpetrate upon us and our peoples of Britain, of the United States, of South Africa, Australia, Canada, and the Commonwealth nations, what is called the Great Tribulation in God's Word. We also then expect that Britain will not be a part of the ultimate 10 nations because Britain is going to receive their wrath. I have stated for decades that I do not believe that Britain will be a part of the 10. And yet Britain has become very much involved in the gradual progression toward a common European currency. But get this, Britain is not one of the 11 signatories. The nations that signed it are as follows: Germany, France, Italy, Belgium, Spain, Portugal, Finland, Austria, Ireland, and the Netherlands, and Luxembourg, but not Great Britain. Britain has decided to wait until after their general elections, and it makes you wonder whether they will ever get around to signing it. Now, what's happening is that in several other countries, things are not going very swimmingly. For example, just the other day, at a meeting of the top national bankers in Greece, in Athens, a lot of skinheads and neo-fascists actually came in, completely disrupted the meeting, rioted, tore the place apart, a very wonderful building and a very wonderful place in like a boardroom of a major bank building, just left the place in a shambles, actually injured some of the men, and many of the dignitaries had to flee out the back door. Why? Because privatization of nationalized industries like airlines and railways and, of course, especially the banks has to take place in these countries to get rid of nationalization of industries and banks in order to prepare the way for the adoption of the euro. So it's not going to just happen very, very smoothly. Now, I've said for decades that the eventual United States of Europe is probably going to arise out of the eventual global collapse of global economies. And with the reverberating shocks of the collapse of the Asian stock market, of the deep troubles that Japan is in deep recession right now, if not depression, and the fact that the United States and the IMF are trying to bail out the yen that is faltering so badly by pumping billions of purely imaginary paper money on a computer, just digits on a computer, based upon the confidence game of the international global economy into Japan to try to stave off Japan dragging some of the other countries down with it. China is in deep trouble, and right now Wall Street is looking very, very nervously over their shoulder, wondering whether or not the Chinese are going to devalue their currency. And if they do, because Americans were running over there immediately trying to get into that vast market, and as you know, a tremendous number of things that we wear and that we drive and that we use are made in China, and the United States entrepreneurs and businessmen have made vast inroads into Asia, not only in China, but into Singapore and in Malaysia. Into, of course, not so much because the Japanese pretty much walled it out, but to some extent in Japan and especially in Korea. And if you've been watching the stock market reports and you know what's happening in the Asian markets, you know how it's impacting the United States and all of Europe, then you know that people who are really losing a lot of large amounts of money are looking very nervously at what is happening in Asia. And I think really if you look behind the mere photo op of Clinton's visit to China, that his visit to China, I think, has to do with a lot of fence mending and bridge building to try to say, because an awful lot of people go along on these presidential summit visits that are at various other echelons and levels, and not just the two heads of state that meet. And there are lots of other meetings that are going to take place, not just the president being received in Tiananmen Square, which is causing an awful lot of mostly Republicans, but even many Democrats as well. To break out in chilblains because of the human rights issue. Well, he's not going over there just to talk to them about human rights or to have a photo op or to get rid of Monica Lewinsky and all of the scandals in the United States. He's going over there to mend some fences and to try to get some reassurances that the Chinese are not going to devalue their currency and to get some reassurances about Chinese missile sales to Iran and other third world countries, and to try to reassure people who are crying treason, as I said in the article you probably read in Newswatch, the last one, China aims nuclear missiles at U.S. cities. And I said in the drop head, many Americans cry treason because of the fact that Ron Brown and his ilk, appointed by President Clinton, were going along and actually taking away from the State Department what really belongs to them and putting it in the venue of the Commerce Department, so that a tremendous amount of these deals involving huge, big American aerospace and technologically technology companies involved in a sale of missile technology, of the guidance systems for our missiles that actually put satellites in orbit, and that technology was sold to the Chinese. Now, you've seen the flap. Probably those of you watching this in Tasmania and Australia haven't seen as much as we have in the United States and Canada, but we've seen a lot of it here, that President Clinton is actually being called a traitor to the country because of the fact that the missile technology of boosting their satellites into orbit, which is the innocent, you know, facade they put on it, is actually giving them the capability to very dramatically improve the targeting ability of their intercontinental ballistic missiles that are aimed at American cities. So I think the real reasons for President Clinton, notwithstanding the gainsayers and people that are shrieking and screaming about don't go over there because of their record of human rights, is to try to settle down some of this stuff. Now, because of the things happening in the world today, not the least of which is this article that came, what is happening in Kosovo, and I'd like to talk about that briefly, I thought what I would do in place of my normal sermon, since we weren't able to send that last one, is just chat with you about some of these things to make you realize what is occupying some of my thoughts, some of my time, some of my concern, and some of the things that I am writing about. I just finished having my son Matthew come over here to my study this morning and gave him both a major article about Kosovo and how the Balkans area could actually be the spark that ignites World War III, then an editorial, then another smaller article about this business of the Southern Baptists and the statement that they have made about the family and all the furor in the United States as a result of that. The two great things in the United States that are causing the liberal media to go crazy today are, first of all, the Southern Baptist statement about the man being the head of his household and the woman being in submission to the man. And secondly, what Trent Lott said in a very mild statement, a very gracious statement, actually, about homosexuality. So the gay rights and the lesbians and all the women's movements are going absolutely insane in the United States, jumping all over Trent Lott because of his statement that homosexuality is a sin. As I told you before, that was why I think the management of WGN years ago took me off of WGN, because I dared to wade through the first chapter of the book of Romans and to quote from the Bible that very likely AIDS is mentioned when it says they, that is queers and homosexuals, are receiving in themselves that recompense of their error which was meet. In other words, receiving the exact penalty for their sin, which is fitting, and that AIDS was not hovering around under a rock waiting for the virus to leap out on somebody for all these years, but is in a sense a man-made virus because of the filthy, abominable practices of sodomy that came out of Africa. And that now the users of drugs, and we know the sharers of needles, and then their girlfriends are actually spreading it into the heterosexual community. There have been many incredibly shocking articles about AIDS, and we cover a little bit of that in World Watch. But there's something like 47 million human beings that carry it right now today. I saw a statistic just the other day, and it is booming, especially in Central Europe and now in Asia. It is rife in Africa. It's made deep inroads into the United States. So these things are of great concern. Isn't it amazing that when someone, even a senator, or the Southern Baptist Church, to which Bill Clinton is a nominal member, and so is Speaker of the House Newt Gingrich, and so is Senator Lott, and a lot of other people are apparently Southern Baptists, and they come out with a statement about the family, in their innocence merely trying to combat the breakup of the family in the United States, the fact that divorce and desertion and abandonment and child abuse and, of course, single parents and same-sex marriages, one was just sanctioned the other day by the Episcopal Church in the United States where a couple of men were, quote, married, end quote, makes you absolutely sick, as I've said years and years ago. One of these days, one of these churches are going to sanction a marriage where a man leads a horse down the aisle. And there are just no limits to how far they're going to go, as God calls them in Isaiah, the first and the third chapter, the leaders of Sodom. Now, because the Southern Baptists dared to quote the Bible, Ephesians 5, that talks about children being obedient to their parents, and Ephesians 5, which draws the analogy of Christ and the church, and Ephesians 6, it talks about children being obedient to their parents, and they dare to quote the Bible, the liberal media and all of these women's groups and the gay rights people in the United States are going absolutely crazy. Now, so much of this is happening. There's just so much to cover that I hardly know where to begin. But I wanted to just chat with you about some of these things today. Back to Kosovo for a minute. If you're keeping up on the news, and we certainly try to help all of you to do that by World Watch and by the tapes that we send you, then you know that all is not well in Kosovo, which is 90% Albanian, ethnic Albanian. Now, the peoples in that area, I read a very lengthy article in Encyclopedia Britannica, 11th edition, just the other day, to refresh my memory about the Slavs and the Serbs. And the Slavic people were really divided merely by geographical distribution, and they're all the same people. Some of that is quoted in the article I just completed for World Watch. The Russians and the Serbs are the same people. They share the same alphabet. They speak the same language. It is not identical, but it is like a dialect in Serbia, but it is like Russian, and Russians can understand it, and Serbs can understand Russians. So continually, the Russians and Serbs have been together. Now, during World War II, when Yugoslavia, that is all those areas of Montenegro and of Bosnia, of Serbia, of Herzegovina, of Macedonia, and of Kosovo, were all overwhelmed by Hitler, the Croats, many of whom are largely Islamic, and the Serbs, many of whom are Orthodox, were really going at it, and there was a lot of ethnic cleansing under the German occupation, but there were a lot of underground cells that sprang up, some under Mihailovic with the Croatians, and some under Tito, who was Serbian, who eventually founded a new government after the Allies were victorious, and Joseph Tito then became like a dictator who put together Yugoslavia, all of these various warring and dissident factions that was in a dictatorship for many, many years that was really tilting toward the communist sphere of influence. But he was his own man, and he was a nationalist and a dictator. Then, of course, when he died, we know that eventually new government came along, and eventually Yugoslavia fragmented. The reason for the fragmentation is because of religion. And primarily it has to do with Islam and Orthodoxy, or Roman Catholicism. And primarily it is the Greek or the Eastern Orthodox and the Islamics who are coming head to head. There are only 10% of the Serbs in Kosovo, that southernmost province next to Macedonia, which is a separate nation. Now, Macedonia is not ancient Macedonia, but it's part of it. The Greeks, who are Eastern Orthodox, still refer to their northernmost territory as Macedonia. And they resent very much the use of the little nation, landlocked, no ports, of Macedonia, of even using the name. But you see, inside Macedonia are ethnic Turks, a very large majority of ethnic Greeks, as well as a few of the Albanian ethnic Islamics. Also inside Macedonia, which is viewed as a buffer state, are about 750 American military advisors and hundreds more of the troops from UN nations that are there to try to, quote, keep the peace. Now here's the scenario. Here's where it gets sticky, which is why I wrote the article that I will have out for you very shortly about whether or not the Balkans could be the place that will be the spark that will ignite World War III. Remember that World War I started in the streets of Sarajevo when a crown prince of the Austro-Hungarian Empire was assassinated in an open touring car right in Sarajevo. There are only 10% ethnic Serbians in Kosovo. And because of their cathedrals there and their holy places, like their churches and cathedrals, then Milosevic wants to impose, not only because of his police, but his actual regular army units that are in Kosovo, Serbian rule and law on these people, but they want independence just like Albania has and just like, of course, Macedonia has. And the Kosovo Liberation Army, or the KLA, are fighting for it. Now, they're very poorly armed. They've only got, like the PA in Palestine, small arms, but an awful lot of Americans who are Albanian descent and a lot of other sympathetic groups are trying to funnel arms to them, and especially some of the Islamic countries. And the littoral of Albania is a very rugged area right on the Adriatic Sea, and there are a lot of little fishing villages there. And it's a great smuggling country, and it has been for many, many years. And they smuggle primarily jewelry, guns, drugs, and cigarettes. But now they're smuggling guns primarily, and of course the KLA is trying to get its hands on mortars and Stingers, the shoulder-mounted anti-aircraft missiles that they can fire at some of those MiGs that are used by the Serbian government. And it could break out into a larger war at any time, and what they fear is that it might spill over into Macedonia. Now, if it does, then Turkey and Greece are going to get involved. Now, you remember that the other day, the United Nations decided to rattle the saber a little bit and to put Milosevic on notice, so they had massive air movements by the overflight of F-16s and Tornadoes and other aircraft right over Serbia and over the border between Albania and Kosovo to try to say to the Serbs, back off, or we might have to intervene. President Boris Yeltsin gets into the act. He asks Milosevic to come up to Moscow because these people have an affinity for each other, and Russia doesn't like, and I can certainly understand their point of view, the gradual encroachment of NATO into Eastern Europe. What is the North Atlantic Treaty Organization that was signed aboard an American cruiser during World War II between Roosevelt and Churchill doing marching into Eastern Europe? How would we feel, how would the British feel if the Warsaw Pact nation had marched into France and the lowlands? We'd feel the same irk, the same ire that the Russians feel about NATO marching right down into some of those Eastern European countries, because NATO is a military alliance. It is not a political or economic alliance. So you really have got to see the Russian point of view in all of this, and the stupidity of the West to kind of kick over the anthill the way they do. Russia then held exercises. It launched its long-range Bear and other bombers in an exercise aimed at launching long-range cruise missiles at the United States. So across from the North Pole came Russian bombers making trial runs at the launch point of cruise missiles with nuclear warheads against the United States. And at the same time the UN aircraft are overflowing the border between Albania and Kosovo, the Turks send a flight of their modern jets, F-16s and others, into Cyprus. When the Turks did that, the Greeks sent some F-16s into the northern part of Grecian Cyprus. And most people are oblivious to this. Most people know nothing about it. They don't get this kind of news, so they're not aware of what could happen. Now, the Greeks and the Turks are both members of NATO. They are NATO allies in what has been characterized as the soft underbelly of Europe. What if war, and it has in the past, it has broken out in the past over Cyprus, what if war were to break out in that region and it would immediately draw Turkey and Greece into conflict with one another, who are NATO partners? It would draw Russia into the fray. It would draw Europe into the fray. And no doubt it would not just this time be the United Nations, but it would be a separate European force. Maybe the Franco-German alliance that have a separate military deal going, and they could all become involved. You know, the Bible, now this may shock you, but it's true, believe it or not. There may be a shadowy reference to it, I'll preface it, by in the book of Daniel, the 11th chapter, there may be a shadowy reference to Hitler, but believe it or not, the Bible did not predict World War I. You can't find it anywhere in the Bible. The Bible did not predict specifically World War II. You can't find Pearl Harbor in the Bible. You can't find the prediction of a war between Manasseh and the people of Javan, if that's who they are, Japan, or the people of Japan, in the Bible. It isn't there. So since these major wars have not always been covered in biblical prophecy, why should some other comparatively smaller wars, such as the more than 65 wars that have taken place between the cessation of World War II and the present time, be predicted, every one of them, somewhere in the Bible? They just are not. The main things that we're to look for in the Bible, as you well know, are the beast power to move into Palestine, Jesus said, armies surrounding Jerusalem, and the abomination of desolation standing in the holy place where it ought not. What I try to do as an observer and as a student of world history, of ancient history, and of current events, to see how they play out in the light of Bible prophecy, is to see who the players are on the world scene, who will comprise the United States of Europe, who will their enemies be, what has been the picture from the time of World War II to the present time during the Cold War, what is most likely to bring about the destruction of Jerusalem and of Israel and the annihilation of an awful lot of Jewish people, and therefore the intervention of a beast power into Palestine, what would cause that, and to get all of this background information so that I can make sense of it and give it to you. So I think that keeping our eyes on what is happening in the Balkans, because it may eventually even bring in Turkey and Greece into conflict one with another, is very, very important. Now, secondly, recently, the PA, that is the Palestinian Authority, has said that the great plan that has been unveiled by Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu for a greater Jerusalem, and they've drawn the lines out now, across the hills and valleys and out in basically uninhabited areas, hitherto where there weren't any apartment complexes and none of the city, and it has just expanded all over. If you've been over there in recent years, you know that Jerusalem is a huge city compared to what it used to be, and it's going to be even greater. So when they talk about the greater New Jerusalem, because the Israeli government is absolutely determined that Jerusalem will never again be divided, and it will be, and they use biblical scriptures to try to back up their claim, the perpetual capital of the nation of Israel. Yasser Arafat the other day said that the laying out of greater Jerusalem, the plan that was unveiled by Netanyahu, was tantamount to a declaration of war. He also said just a few days before that, that if the Israelis don't pull back from that 13% that our First Lady, quote-unquote, over here, opened her mouth about at some time a few weeks earlier, which absolutely enraged the Israelis. Why don't we just give them 13%? Didn't know what she was talking about. But now, Yasser Arafat has said that if they don't pull out soon from these areas that he insists they ought to abandon and turn over to the Palestinian Authority, that the military option might have to be used. So really, on virtually a daily basis, we could hear of a greater war in the Balkans. We could hear of a war breaking out between Israel and the Palestinians and other Arab countries coming in. Now, in the backdrop of all of this, we have the information about the explosion of nuclear weapons by both India and Pakistan, and by the sending of technology to Iran to improve their missile program. And it was stated by one of the leaders of, believe it was the head of the Labor Party, I forget, just the other day in Israel. I saw the interview and I've forgotten who he was, that was saying, how long do we think it will be until one day we wake up and Iran has also exploded a nuclear device? He says it is inevitable, if not now, in 2000, 2001, 2002, 2003, 2004. It is inevitable, and he's absolutely right. It is inevitable. I know that there are people in some of the fragmented little churches that spun off from the worldwide church who are busily engaging in a lot of religiosity, a lot of religious phraseology, a lot of praise worship, a lot of religious publications, and a lot of judging one another, a lot of moral outrage at other people, and a lot of blame-placing and name-calling and going to church and just having a nice binge of churchianity. Well, let them go on and do that. That's fine. But that's not my calling. It's not what concerns me. It's not what I read about. It's not what I write about. It's not what I pray about. It's not what I am concerned about from the standpoint of my children and my grandchildren. It's not what I'm concerned about from the standpoint of the future of my beloved United States of America. And I am an American and I can't help it. I make no apology for that. To you Canadians and Australians, I love you all. I love your countries. But I'm an American. And you have a right to love your country and have a certain pride and thanksgiving toward God that you are Canadian or Australian or wherever else you might be seeing this tape. But it's hard for me to understand why these people will ignore biblical prophecy and, even as one person did, make a cutting and a sardonic remark about headline religion. Well, there's nothing religious about headlines, but you know, I have asked time and time again over these many, many years, what is religious about a drought and what is religious about a famine? I'm asking that question to get people's attention, to unlock them from their, you know, stayed old in the rut idea about no concern whatsoever toward Europe, utter ignorance on the part of most Americans walking the street about what's taking place in Europe or in the Balkans or in the near or the Far East or Asia, the rim of Pacific Rim, what it's called. No, you know, concept at all about the meaning of biblical prophecy. And so I will say, well, what is religious about a drought? Because Christ predicted droughts. And here we are in Texas in the middle of a drought. A terrible drought. The governor of Texas the other day said it was something in the order of, I think it was $2.1 billion crop loss. And we got a call the other day from a lady in Florida who actually smells and is, her eyes are stinging from the smoke of the many, many fires burning in Florida that have now leapt across the Georgia border. And only a couple of weeks earlier, my eyes were smarting, my lungs were hurting, and it affected my lungs and respiratory system from the more than 1,000 fires burning in Mexico. And the smoke was so thick you could smell it and see it and taste it right here in East Texas where I live. So when I see the Midwest, being torn up by thunderstorms and huge hail and violent tornadoes taking lives and demolishing towns and floods and rains everywhere up there, then we're in the middle of a drought, and I look at what it says in biblical prophecy, I think there may be something going on here. And so I try to portray that to people. Now, back to this article I started out with that, and I have gotten off on these other subjects, but they all are interrelated, and they all are definitely overlapping each other. This irks me a little bit, and I'll tell you why, and I think all of you will understand. He said the first big story of the 21st century is already happening, and nobody noticed. at least nobody back home in the United States. And he was writing from Paris. His name is Richard Reeves, and he is a nationally syndicated columnist in the United States. He said, that is the United States of America. The story is about the United States of Europe, but it's not noticed by the United States of America. He went on to say, toward the end of this article, it seems people just hoarded euros, talking about the new currency that is to be launched in January of 1999, and that it's being test marketed, and people are buying it as a souvenir because it's a unique and a strange looking new kind of a money, and selling it to tourists. But, truth be told, a lot has already happened in Europe that no one could have predicted only a few years ago. Where has this man been? You know, that irks me a little bit, because for now these 45 years, I have been predicting that Europe would coalesce, that Germany would be reunited, that the Eastern European countries, and I named them one by one back in the 60s, and the proof is there in the booklet that I wrote entitled United Europe, How Soon? And here were 54 quotations from the old issues of the Plain Truth magazine, the Good News magazine, Tomorrow's World magazine, from our own publications in the former church organization, the CGI, from many of my television programs, from some of my sermons delivered in personal appearance campaigns, constantly, repetitiously, talking about the coming United States of Europe, and that it would involve the heartland of Europe, that it would include some of the Eastern European nations, that it would form the beast power of Revelation 17, and that it would move into Palestine. Now, here's why I pay attention to the headlines. Because that beast power is going to impose the mark of the beast, and the image of the beast has been made in the exact image, or the, as I said in the television program, I finished just before this chat with you, or the Roman civil government, and it is going to martyr, it is going to murder people who will not bow down and worship that system and will not accept the mark of the beast and the number of his name. And I happen to know that the mark or the identifying sign that Almighty God placed between God and his people is God's Sabbath day. Read Exodus 31. And I know that the counterfeit of that is this Sunday-keeping, sun-worshipping, Sunday world in which we live. And I know, too, that there have been many thousands, and there are people that came up to me as recently as our visit up into Michigan during the day of Pentecost that were just absolutely agonizing over the fact that this wage earner, the breadwinner for his family, was having a terrible time. He felt guilty. He was under the gun. He knew he ought to keep the Sabbath, but to him it just felt like, I can't. I'll lose my job. I won't have any way to support my family. I've got all these kids. I've got these car payments. I've got my mortgage payment. What would I do? It is agony. And it says, no man may buy or sell save he receive the mark of the beast. And I'll tell you, when you investigate it, and you know that the Bible says that when the symbolic lives that were lost are calling out as if from the soil, O God, how long will you not avenge our blood on them that dwell on the earth? And it is told them that they must wait a little while until their fellow servants shall be killed as they were. And they are to be martyred for the same reason. And why were these killed? Because they refused to receive the mark of the beast. Because they refused to bow down to it. Now, as I said in the television program just before this message that I'm delivering to you today, Halley's Bible Handbook recounts how 900,000 only in one era of the Inquisition were slain who were quarto decimans that were clinging to the Passover on the 14th. And this was in Central Europe, and they were among the Valdensians and the Vaudois. They were 900,000. That's nearly a million people. And there were tens of thousands of others down through the century that were slain for the same reason. When the Roman Catholic Church was ferreting out people who would dare to observe the Sabbath, who would not accept the Trinity, who would not recite the Apostles' Creed, who don't recite and sing the doxology, and who believe in God's Sabbath days and God's annual holy days. And the time is going to come when they are going to kill people who observe those laws of God. The only sign between God and his people is the Sabbath, is what God says. And the sign that you're just a happy-go-lucky mainstream Protestant evangelical is that you go to church on Sunday. Now, a lot of people might not agree with that, but that is absolutely proven from biblical history and will be proven in the future from biblical prophecy, and there's simply no doubt about it. So for people who want to play church and who want to take rotten, hypocritical pot shots at me for dealing with prophecy and with what's happening in the world and look down despectively down their nose at it and say, well, that's headline religion, let them go on and have their play. But I'll guarantee you, I am very concerned because when the headlines say that if anyone is caught observing the Sabbath, then everyone is going to pay more attention to the headlines, aren't they? And when the time comes that people are going to impose that upon Sabbatarians and Sabbath keepers, then look out because some of the prophecies of God are going to come to pass. For 45 years, I have talked about the coming of the United States of Europe. I mentioned those 54 quotations in that booklet. I could go back and recount some of them, but most of you are very, very aware of that. Most of you read that booklet. But you know, when we went, Mark is right here behind the camera with me right now, and my son David is in the other room. When we went to Berlin in the latter part of 1989, just after the wall had come down, and we got there for the second weekend of that great celebration, I couldn't stand not to go to Berlin. I had to go over there and see that with my own eyes. That wall was coming down, and I had known that it was going to, and I had known that Germany was going to reunite for decades. Now, it was happening right before my eyes. I couldn't believe that the head then of the worldwide church, I've told this before, and I want to briefly recount it because it is important. It is a little bit of history, and it's something for which people are going to give account before God in the judgment. He was the person who inherited the worldwide church from my father, and he shouldn't have. And in my opinion, he had no right to it. And he was not the actual successor of my father. I am. But in any event, he received all of the infrastructure and the money and the church membership, the worldwide church, and the entire heritage that he should have received, which was my father's life. My father's life's work. My father's lifetime was dedicated to the work, the work, the work. And he preached continually that Germany was going to reunite. And he began doing that in 1944 when he said the Germans are going to go underground and there will come yet a new ultra-rightist, ultra-nationalistic, Nazi-like movement in Germany. And there will emerge a new dictator in Germany. And it will once again rise to become a great power in Europe. It will become the central power in Europe. It will be the beast power. It will be the head of those 10 nations. My father had said it over and over and over again. Here was the editorial by that man, and it's a matter of record, and some of you have got it there in your attic or your closet, on the January 1990 issue of The Plain Truth, and it had that blue European flag with the stars in a circle around it of the 11 nations or whatever, but it only had one article by Ronald Kelly in there that was interviewing some of the Habsburgs. It was a very minor article, and the real powerful witness and warning in that article was as follows, quote, let him that build the house, if the Lord be not the builder of the house, however it goes, they build it in vain. And that was the warning about the building of a united Europe. But in the editorial, it was entitled No Magic Words. And the man that wrote it, who is now dead of cancer, said, there are no magic words to salvation. And he went on to say, this reminds me of Alibaba and the 40 Thieves, of how he said, you know, abracadabra or something. And he was just writing a little article about there isn't any magic shortcut to salvation, and then going into some of the scriptures about salvation. I was astounded. So instead, I brought out a special issue. We only had one issue out of those many, many months because we couldn't afford it at that time, of our full-color magazine that I wanted to keep going and should have been kept going if the business manager had allowed it. Every single month of what we called then Watch Magazine. Now I have World Watch, the newsletter. And I had a major article, New Order Coming in Germany, which I later made into a booklet, The United States of Europe, How Soon? And there were those 54 quotations. So I went back and I ferreted out all of these many statements made by some of the earliest pioneers of the student body who came to Ambassador College. And those people actually included people like Raymond McNair and Rod Meredith and Herman Hay and my brother Dick Armstrong and myself and so on. And the old plain truth from all the way back into the mid-1950s, and I quoted from those and from the Good News magazine, and I brought it forward right down to that current time. And I didn't take all of them by any means, but I ferreted out 54 of them. To quote how we so consistently had said, a United States of Europe is going to form, and it's going to be the biggest enemy the United States has ever seen. Now, here is this article, United States of Europe deserves a look, and he says this. You see if my eye will fall on the part that I want to read to you. Yes, he says, the story is about the United States of Europe, an entity of 300 million people nicknamed Euroland, the 11 countries that have agreed to merge their currencies. At the end of this year, the countries will begin the process of eliminating marks, francs, lira, and eight other national currencies and creating a new currency, the euro. And then he went on to talk about the coming United States of Europe, and this is the interesting part. What will happen? It is guesswork, however educated, talking about the adoption of the common currency. The United States is not even guessing. If anyone even knows what is going on over here, why aren't Americans paying attention? Monica Lewinsky, I guess. The American focus on scandal has become scandalous. There has been little debate and little information and less debate back home in the, quote, lone superpower, end quote, on the two world-changing events, the expansion of NATO into Eastern Europe and the coming of the euro. Why shouldn't God's people be aware of world-changing events? Are God's people supposed to be like the proverbial, it's not true, of course, ostrich that allegedly, it isn't true, sticks its head in the sand? Where was Daniel when great events shaped the world? Daniel was right in the capital city, in the king's palace, and actually ran the government for the king while Nebuchadnezzar was rooting around in the backyard absolutely out of his mind. That's where God's prophet was at that time. Where was Noah when God was going to destroy the entire world by a flood? Did Noah pay attention to the headlines? Or was Noah just giving them a new form of how to hold their hands when they prayed? I mean, was Noah performing a religious service and saying, now, let us pray. Oh, dear Lord, it's so nice to be gathered together here in the love and the mercy of the Lord this day as I stand on the edge of the ark with all you people with your adzes and your draw knives over there and resting now from our work of building this ark. Or wasn't the ark a statement all by itself? And didn't Noah, as he progressively probably talked to larger audiences from a little higher up on the ark, keep warning them for 120 long years, the most unsuccessful prophet in the history of the world? He warned these hard-headed, stiff-necked, lustful, sinning people who he actually had employed to help him build the ark for 120 years that they were all going to drown like rats if they didn't repent. They didn't repent, and they drowned like rats. The most unsuccessful preacher in the history of the world. Even his own children didn't believe him. His own wife didn't accept what he said. He stood alone. Noah, only in his generations, was a man righteous before God, which is why Ezekiel was led to say much later in Ezekiel 18, 4 and 20, the soul that sinneth, it shall die. That even though Noah, Daniel, and Job, and Ezekiel was contemporary with Daniel, so he must have known him, and he knew what a righteous man he was. He said, though Noah, Daniel, and Job be in it, that is in the land, they shall not save their families, but only themselves because of their own righteousness. Everybody's sin will be on his own head. Where were the prophets of God when the times got really rough in the world? They were sent to the kings. They were sent to the governor. They were sent to the head of state. They were right there in the capital city. They were warning the people who were bringing all the wrath of God upon the people because of their sinning ways, whether it was King Ahab or Ahaz or King Manasseh, and of how cruel and heartless they were. Thus saith the Lord. And that's what they said. Again, I don't want to dwell on this, but I have heard recently, and I'll just make passing reference to it. If you haven't heard it, it's not important, that someone in the other organization has also taken a little bit of a pot shot at Ezekiel and trying to claim that perhaps these prophecies are basically all for old time and have been done away. Well, if anything was even hinted in that direction, that is absolute nonsense, and it's not true. The book of Ezekiel is more than 90% for our time. Ezekiel was a prophet who was given prophecy after prophecy after prophecy that has to do with the second coming of Christ, the reestablishment of all of Israel according to the old waste places. Look at Ezekiel 36. It is a series of chapters that are actually developed chronologically leading up to the time of the great white throne judgment and the establishment of the new heavens and the new earth. It even gives a picture in Ezekiel 47 of the great white throne judgment, the resurrection of the whole physical tribe of Israel in the valley of dry bones. It gives a prophecy of that great river that is seen in both Zechariah 14 and Revelation 21 that shall flow from beneath the very throne of God to go out and heal the waters of all the rivers. Here is a prophecy for the future. I believe that these men gave their lives, and sometimes in a very horrible way, when you look at the bed sores that he must have gotten on his body from lying on his one side from all that interminable period of time in order to display something to the Israelites that were there in that encampment with him and in order to write it down so that we see it today. And that his wife died right in the middle of his work, and it said he rose up that evening and went on and did the work of God. And the only personal comment, the only thing we know about Ezekiel, we don't know anything about whether he had children. The only personal comment that is ever made about Ezekiel by Ezekiel: in the morning my wife died, in the evening I went on and did the work of God. That's the only thing it is stated. And it is a book that is for our time. And I believe, since Jesus Christ, in the longest dissertation of all of his prophecies, of all the statements that he made, the longest nonstop dissertation that he gave his disciples just before his death is the Olivet Prophecy. And in that Olivet Prophecy, one great event after another. And they have to do with religious persecution as well as with wars and droughts and famines. And I'm going to turn to that because I hadn't intended to, but there is a part of that that is very, very important. Because, you know, I could probably journey to the South Sea Islands and burst in upon a group of pagans somewhere out there about to sacrifice to their great Ooga Booga, whatever they would call him. And, of course, you know that idol busting or idol bashing is not a healthy pastime. I could take issue with Hindus and walk over, as I've been to India, and go back there, and instead of just driving around the indolent cows chewing their cuds in the intersection and forming a great traffic block, get out there like any other Texan and pick up a stick and job those cows out of the way and say, get out of here, and whack those cattle, the Brahma cattle, over the back. But I would get myself killed. So what I'm saying is, I could attack heathen religions, pagan religions, and I could get myself killed. Who would be the most illogical people on the face of this earth to try to put me to death? Why, members of God's church. That's, to me, the most illogical thing I can imagine. But let me tell you, who hates me the most? No, I won't tell you. I'll let you make up your own mind. Let you make up your own mind. Those heathens don't hate me, by and large. And a lot of these people hear my programs, and I make no bones at all about, as I did in the telecast just before this chat I'm having with you today, so that it's very, very clear what I mean when I say the image of the beast and who is going to impose the mark of the beast, and talk about the pogroms that were carried out by the papacy during the Dark Ages and when many, many hundreds of thousands were slain at the behest of the Pope of that day. Very, very plain. But none of the Knights of Columbus have shown up at my doorstep so far. Now, it doesn't mean they won't at some point in time. But it's interesting that what Jesus said here over and over again had to do with persecution. He said, when he talked about wars, rumors of wars, droughts and famines and pestilences and earthquakes, all these are the beginning of sorrows. Verse 9, then shall they deliver you up to be afflicted and shall kill you, and you shall be hated of all nations for my name's sake. And that's not because of your song services or your potlucks or your belief in the dietary laws or necessarily even because you observe God's Sabbath day. But it is because you will not recant, and you won't accept the Trinity, and you won't accept Sunday, and you won't accept the mark of the beast. He said, and then shall many be offended. And oh, do people find little reasons why they are offended. Do you know, let me just tell you something. It didn't occur to me. I just got to share it with you right now while I'm talking. Do you know one of the biggest hurdles that an awful lot of people who claim to be Christian are going to have to get over before they ever make it into God's kingdom? One of the biggest hurdles for them to surmount, one of the biggest questions that may cost them their salvation, you're looking at him. They're going to have to deal with their attitude toward me. They're going to have to forgive me. That's all I'm going to say. I didn't do anything against them. They're going to have to deal with me. And that is amazing when I think of it that way, because if any of us in our hearts and our minds have any human being anywhere, and we all know this if we know anything at all about the teachings of Christ, even in the Beatitudes, even in Matthew 7 and verse 1, judge not that you be not judged, and it means condemn not that you be not condemned. That if you have aught against your brother, said Christ, you go and you reconcile your problem with your brother, and then you come and present your gift. Now that is analogous to prayer. If you have aught against anybody, there's somebody you detest, somebody you hate, somebody you just can't stand, somebody that just causes great moral outrage, you just can't stand them. And you get on your knees every night and pray to God, sorry, he isn't hearing a word you say. What will open God's ears is if you forgive from the heart, from the depths of your soul, anyone against whom you have anything. I'd never thought of it in quite that way before, but there are lots of people and organizations and individuals out there that may at some point in time find out they've got a very large hurdle to cross, and I'm it. Just occurred to me, that's all. And I think that's biblical. I think that's what God's Word says. Many shall be offended and shall betray one another. I know, not to the same extent because it didn't cost me my life. It merely cost a fabulous infrastructure, $1 million in properties, a 65,000 mailing list, a wonderful organization. I know what it's like to be betrayed. And it says, and they shall hate one another. And many false prophets shall rise. Now he gets into the abomination of desolation, and then the great tribulation. And he says it will be a time of trial such as has never before occurred. And then at the end of it, he says, verse 24, for there shall arise false Christs and false prophets and shall show great signs and wonders, insomuch that, if it were possible, they should deceive the very elect. And again, zeroes in on religious deception and religious persecution. So you see, you cannot really take the headlines of the great world-changing events like were covered in that clipping, the United States of Europe emerging, NATO encroaching into Eastern Europe, the problems in Kosovo, the problems in Palestine, the problems between Pakistan and Bangladesh, the problems of drought and famine and earthquakes and disease epidemics and AIDS spreading all over the world. You cannot take the headlines and separate those from religion. Well, you can. I mean, people do it. But you can't do it and be involved in God's work, and you can't do it and be obedient to Jesus Christ of Nazareth. Because Jesus Christ of Nazareth didn't do that. He absolutely showed that the great world events that are going to impact God's people are events which are eventually going to result in the martyrdom of those who will refuse the mark of the beast and who will stick to God's word and his work and will be doing his work faithfully. They will remain absolutely faithful to that work of God right to the end of their lives or to the end of their work, whichever comes first. And that's why later on he says in verse 44, therefore be ye also ready, for in such an hour as you think not, the Son of Man cometh. Who then is a faithful and wise servant, whom his Lord has made ruler over his household to give them meat in due season? Blessed is that servant whom, when his Lord cometh, he shall find so doing. And that means being involved in the work of God. I want to tell you before I close now, just to share a few things with you, that we have had excellent responses to WGN, really above what I thought we would. I thought if we got to 200, it would be great. It's been more like 400 and some. The first time we had over 360, just as in a combination of the calls and the letters that came to our office, but there was more than another 120 some that came to the email address that people tapped into our website. So we had well over 420. Now, I look at what's happening as a result of the one that we just saw this morning, and by the time I'm doing this, we had already had over 220 before we even began the television program and this chat with you today to replace the sermon tape that we didn't send out. I wanted you to know that because we're headed apparently toward about 1,500 responses to build our mailing list out of those four programs on WGN, and we will know by the end of next week when the next one airs. And already, when I did a little quick tabulation this morning, it's down to about $10 a call. And that's what it, here's what it means. All of you know, of course, the way we operate, the way we have always operated, that we never request money and everything we give away is free of charge. We paid $4,500 for each half hour on WGN. That's $18,000. You talk about somebody's hand trembling a little bit when you make out a check. That's a little frightening, but that's God's money. And it's the money many of you people are sending to me to do God's work with. And that's what you want done with it. You don't want it done to spend to buy me a new Cadillac. You want it done to get this work out there before the millions of people that need to see it. And so we put that $18,000 into WGN. And it's going to result in at least, I imagine, $1,500, if not more. It would take $1,800 to get $10 a letter. Maybe it'll go to that. Of new names, new families on our mailing list. And listen, some of them are former coworkers who lost track of me over 20 years ago. There are people calling in at that odd hour of 6 a.m. on Monday morning up and down the eastern seaboard of the United States who said, I wondered what happened to you way back in 1978. Now, isn't that fabulous? That with all that we did, with all the 54 radio stations I was on before we shifted on TV and the CGI, that it took to this moment for some of these people to tune in. You know why I think they are? Because I had asked many of you, brethren, to pray that at the time that that program is on, God would somehow, just through the power of His Holy Spirit, open minds, cause them just to be clicking around on their remote, you know, and to tune in to WGN. And sure enough, a lot of them had called and wrote, said, I just happened to be clicking around, and there he was again. And they found that program. And I think that is absolutely wonderful. So, I'm going to bring this to a close before I run out of tape, but I've enjoyed chatting with you. I want to show you real quickly, Mark, I'll tell you what, we hadn't planned on doing this, but just start at the desk and just go up right over here. I'm sitting in my room where I have some trophies that I collected about 30 years ago. I want to show you a little bit where we do our television program from as we close here. We do it right here from my study. We move the furniture around. And here are some of my heads. You're probably seeing the elk and the deer. And Mark might zoom down and zero in on one of my many paintings. I've got several of them around the room here. That's the first time I ever tried to do any sheep. But there is a sheep painting that I did. I made that up. Well, I had some pictures of some sheep I looked at, but I made up all the rest of it. And I decided I didn't want to let go of that one. I'd given away a lot of my paintings, but I decided to hang that one on my own wall to keep it and keep up above the desk here and come back. And anyway, this is the room that we always do our television programs in, and I just thought I'd share it with those of you along the way on the tape program because many of you are hosting fellowship groups in your own homes, and I thought I'd show you where we do our telecast and where I had this chat with you today. So thank you all for watching. God bless you all. We appreciate your prayers, and we really appreciate your support. And you can see what a great work it is doing. Until next time, Garner Ted Armstrong, goodbye, friends.